We pick up the story of Nehemiah in chapter 8, and we look today at chapters 8, 9, 10 and 11. We saw previously in chapter 6, verse 15, that the wall was finished. The great job that Nehemiah had been engaged in was now completed. The wall was finished, and now we come to the dedication of the wall. At the end of chapter 7, the very last sentence in chapter 7 tells us that it is the seventh month. Now, the seventh month was the month when the mid-year festival season began. The Israelite festivals were grouped around two main periods, at the beginning of the first half of the year and at the beginning of the second half of the year. This now is the beginning of the second half of the year, which produces the blowing of the trumpets, and then the Great Day of Atonement, and also the Feast of Tabernacles. We find now that Ezra, that's the same Ezra that we read about in the book of Ezra, Ezra, who had come back to Jerusalem 13 years before Nehemiah, now joins with Nehemiah in seeking to bring the people into a fitting spiritual condition for the dedication of the wall. But all the events we're going to talk about today are in relation to the completion and now the dedication of the wall. Firstly, Ezra the scribe gathers the people together. Ezra is both a priest and a scribe. You find that frequently referred to in the book of Ezra, and you find it referred to again here. The scribe was the person who copied out the law for those who wanted to read it. And during the time in captivity, the scribes had become very important people in the Israelite system. In many ways, they had become more important than the priests, because while the people were in captivity, I'm going back now a century earlier when they were in captivity in Babylon, while they were in captivity, they could not have any temple, no sacrifices, because the temple had been destroyed, and of course sacrifices could be offered only upon the altar in the temple. So during the period of captivity, there were no sacrifices, and as a result, we find that there was greater attention given to the study of the law. Ezekiel was one of the priests who devoted himself to this job of teaching the people the moral implications of the law. And when they came back into the land, this continued. Even after the rebuilding of the temple and the reinstitution of the priesthood and the sacrifices, this emphasis on teaching the law continued, and the scribes continued to be important people. Ezra is both a scribe and a priest. The reason the scribes rose to this importance was that people tended to look upon them as very learned because of their great skill in copying out the law and, of course, paying great attention to the details of the law. Now in chapter 8, Ezra is the man who rounds up the people to read them the law of God, to prepare them so that they will know afresh what God requires of them. Now Ezra had already done this back in the book of Ezra. When he first went back 13 years previously, he had tried to reform the people, and he had had some success, but not a lot of success. And now he seems to get some added impetus with the arrival of Nehemiah and the completion of the city wall. So you find Nehemiah and Ezra now working together very closely. All the people in verse 1 gathered as one man into the square before the water gate, one of the gates of the city. And they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel, because it was the scribe's job now to read the law. Originally, of course, it was the priest's job, but the scribes now seem to have taken that over very largely. But Ezra is also a priest, and you find that mentioned in verse 2. In verse 1 he's the scribe, in verse 2 he's the priest. So he is well fitted for this task of reading and explaining the law. In verse 2, he brought the law before the assembly, both men and women, and all who could hear with understanding, on the first day of the seventh month. He read from it, facing the square before the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of men and women, and those who could understand. So I would imagine children from 12 or 13 years of age and upwards. And the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. It must have been some time since they had had this type of reading of the law. They had fallen away from their original enthusiasm when Ezra first went back, and the law had been somewhat neglected over the last decade or so. And so they listened with great attention. Various people helped Ezra, and you'll find them mentioned in the next few verses. You come down to halfway through verse 8, verse 7 rather. There's various names in verse 7, and it says, all these people helped the people to understand the law while the people remained in their places. And they read from the book, from the law of God, clearly, and they gave the sense so that the people understood the reading. Some very important features there. They not only read the law, they read it clearly, and they explained it. They gave the sense so that the people understood. And I'm convinced that this is still what is required today. It's the word of God that is living and active and sharper than a sword and can pierce into the souls of people. Perhaps we spend too much time just preaching, 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 and not enough of that time is spent actually in the word. So often a half-hour sermon will maybe have two or three brief references to occasional scriptures, and then most of the time is spent with the preacher talking. And I think we ought to change things around so that most of the time is spent doing what's being done here, and what I'm trying to do in these studies on Nehemiah, and that is reading from it, giving it sense so that people can understand it. And I am utterly convinced that once we understand it, the message will be so obvious to us, we'll wonder why we didn't see it in the first place. The Holy Scriptures, the Word of God, has its own power, and it will make itself meaningful and applicable to the lives of God's people once it is understood. They read from it, they read from it clearly, they gave the meaning so that the people understood. And when the people did understand what it was all about, you very soon find that they are responding. In verse 9, Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra the priest, the two men working together, the civil leader and the religious leader, Ezra the priest and the scribe and the Levites who taught the people, said to the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep." For the people wept when they heard the words of the law. You see, they had been so struck by the words of the law that they wept when they realized how far they had departed from it. They came under conviction. And Nehemiah really doesn't quite know how to feel, because he had assembled the people together for a great celebration. He thought, we're going to celebrate the completion of the wall. This is a great day in Jerusalem's history. And when the people come together, instead of rejoicing, they're all starting to weep and to cry. And the occasion that Nehemiah had intended to be a joyful occasion is now one of considerable grief, as the people are struck how they have departed from God's law. He said to them in verse 10, "Go your way, eat and drink, eat fat and drink sweet wine, and send portions to him for whom nothing is prepared. Help the poor and the needy," in other words. "For this day is holy to the Lord, and don't be grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." So he wants them to be positive. Even though they have had this grief because of their departure from God's law, he nevertheless wants them to be positive. And I think we have to have that same combination in our lives. Not to be morbid and morose. Certainly we may come under conviction. Certainly we're to put right what has gone wrong. I trust that we can be positive and joyful Christians and not convey the impression to the people at large that Christianity is a very grim business. There's a joy about the whole thing, and we've got to let that joy come through. Well, that was the first day, and that was a gathering for the people in general. Now, in verse 13, we come to the second day, and on this occasion, only the heads of the people are gathered. All the leaders of the people are gathered, along with the priests and the Levites. And they came together to Ezra the scribe in order to study the words of the law. That was a good spin-off, wasn't it? At last, you've got people now who have been so moved that they're going to do a bit of serious study of the words of the law. So in verse 14, they found it written in the law that the Lord had commanded by Moses that the people of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month. Booths, or tabernacles, or tents, or shelters, temporary shelters that the people erected, and they lived in these for 7 days in commemoration of their time in the wilderness, their 40 years in the wilderness back in the time of Moses, when they had only very temporary accommodation. Well, at the Feast of Tabernacles, the word tabernacle incidentally has nothing at all to do with the place of worship, the tabernacle. It simply means a booth or a tent or a shelter where they lived during their time in the wilderness, and so during this feast they commemorate that by living in these temporary shelters for a week. They found it written in the law of Moses concerning that, and so you read on the rest of the chapter, they did it. That particular feast lasted from round about the 15th or 16th day through 1 week to the 22nd day of the month. And then 2 days after it was concluded, in chapter 9, verse 1, we come to the 24th day. The law is really having its effect upon the people. And so now they turn to God in fasting and sackcloth, in verse 1. In verse 2, they separate themselves from all foreigners and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. It doesn't mean to say that they become racist, but rather it means that some of those relationships where people had been marrying non-Christian people, if I can use that expression, those who didn't believe in God, heathen in other words, a problem that Ezra had to deal with, and later on you find that Nehemiah's got to deal with it again. It was a constant problem for these people. They came under conviction over that also. Verse 3, they stood up in their place and read from the book of the law of the Lord their God for a quarter of the day, and for another quarter of the day they made confession and worshipped. So here again you find this great devotion to the law of God. And this developed in the years that went by, just skipping over things a little bit here and looking at what developed from this. This is how the synagogues and the teaching of the law that went on in the synagogues, this is how it all started and how it developed. As people who had been in captivity, not only those who had come back into the land, but those who were scattered in all sorts of other countries around the empire, as they devoted themselves to meeting together regularly to read and to study the law, so it was that this emphasis grew up. And here we have the origins, you might say, of the synagogues that we meet later on in the New Testament. The synagogues were simply meeting places where the Jews came together and they read the law of God, they prayed, and they had a sermon. There were no sacrifices in the synagogue. The synagogue was not a temple. There was only one temple, only one place where the Jews made sacrifices, and that was at the temple in Jerusalem. But all over the countryside, there were synagogues. Wherever there was a community of Jews large enough to warrant one, they had a synagogue, and the people met for the reading of the law, for prayer, and for worship. And so here again, you can see how all of this was developing during this period. Chapter 9 then goes on to talk about, or to record, the prayer which Ezra prayed on behalf of the nation. Ezra is a great man of prayer. If you go back to the book of Ezra, you find some magnificent prayers that this man prayed. You look at the Old Testament and three people, probably four people, stand out as having some magnificent prayers. Moses, Samuel, Ezra, and Daniel. And of course, I could add on to that David with all his psalms. But just thinking of the narrative sections of the Old Testament and some of the prayers that are recorded, Ezra is right to the forefront in his prayers. Read them for yourselves and enter into the spirit of them, and I'm sure that you can find great blessing. We're not going to read it through. It's a fairly lengthy prayer. He goes back to the beginning to recount God's great work, his great acts of grace for Israel. He talks also about the nation's rebellion, but God in his grace forgives. And he comes to verse 32 as he has now recounted all these things. And he says, "Now therefore our God, the great and mighty and terrible God, who keepest covenant and steadfast love, let not the hardship seem little to thee that has come upon us, upon our kings, our princes, priests, prophets, our fathers, and all thy people since the time of the kings of Assyria until this time. And yet thou hast been just in all that has come upon us." He's pleading for mercy, but he's not in any way accusing God of injustice. He realizes that Israel got its deserts. "Thou hast been just in all that has come upon us. For thou hast dealt faithfully, and we're the ones who've acted wickedly. Our kings, our princes, our priests, our fathers, they've not kept thy law or heeded thy commandments and thy warnings which thou didst give them. They did not serve thee in their kingdom and in thy great goodness which thou gavest them and in the large and rich land which thou didst set before them. They did not turn from their wicked works. And behold now, this day," he says, "we are slaves. In the land that thou gavest to our fathers to enjoy its fruits and its good gifts, behold, we are slaves." Well, they weren't literal slaves, but they were under the control of Persia. Persia was still the dominating country. These people were under the rule of Persia. They were not free. They were not independent. And it was only a concession of the Persian government that they were even allowed to have Nehemiah, one of their own people, as their governor. But even Nehemiah was answerable to the Persians. And so in their own land, they are under foreign domination. And verse 37, its rich yield goes to the kings, that is the foreign kings, that you've set over us because of our sins. They have power also over our bodies, over our cattle, at their pleasure. And we are in great distress. So he cries out to God for mercy. Now, because of all this, he says in verse 38, we make a firm covenant and write it, and our princes, our Levites, and our priests set their seal to it. So as they come together now, read God's word, and are ready for the dedication of the wall, they make a covenant. They set out in this covenant promises. They say to God, we enter an agreement with you, and we promise to keep your law. We promise to obey. And they detail some of the specific things that they will be faithful in. And then when they make this covenant, this promise, they draw up the document, and then it is signed, as he says in the last verse of chapter 9, it is signed and sealed by the representatives of the people. Then in the following verses in chapter 10, you see lots and lots of names. And these are the names of the people who signed it. They represent various groups. In verse 1, you find Nehemiah the governor. He is the first to sign it. You come down to verse 8, and it says those names that we've just had, they are the priests. They signed it. Verse 9, it introduces us to the Levites who signed it. And then verse 14 introduces us to the chiefs of the people, that is the tribal leaders and the family heads. They signed it. And then in verse 28, the rest of the people all join together, even though they don't sign it, they join together in an open declaration of support. And in verse 29, they join with their brethren, their nobles, that is those who've signed it on their behalf, they join with their brethren, their nobles, and enter into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, and which Ezra and his friends have read to them and explained for them. So the people are serious about it, and they make this pledge to be obedient to God. There are six or seven specific things they mention, and I'm just going to mention a few of these now, draw your attention to them, because they do play a part later on. We may not read them all through, but I'll summarise them for you. Now, the first thing they mention is in verse 30, and it concerns mixed marriages, that is, marriage with people who are not believers in God. We will not give our daughters to the people of the land or take their daughters for our sons. So there's one thing they say, we won't engage in marriage with heathen. Secondly, in verse 31, we will keep the Sabbath. If the people of the land bring in wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we won't buy from them. We're going to keep the Sabbath. Verse 32, they talk about payment of the temple tax to maintain the temple and its services. We'll do that, they say. Verse 33 and verse 34, they said, we will pay for the maintenance of all that goes on in the temple. So they're going to pay the tax in verse 32, and then verse 33 and verse 34, they say, we are going to provide all the cereal for the cereal offerings, we'll provide all the food that's needed for all the feasts, and we'll look after the priests and Levites. In verse 35 and 36, they talk about the first fruits. They're going to offer the first fruits to God, and the firstborn of their families they'll dedicate to God according to the law. Verse 37, they say, we're going to bring the first of our coarse meal and our contributions, the fruit of every tree, the wine, the oil. We're going to bring these to the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God, and to bring to the Levites the tithe from our ground, for it is the Levites who collect the tithes in all our rural towns. So they say, we're going to tithe as we should, and give all our tithes so that we can support the Levites, who in turn can support the priests, and so keep the whole system going. And they're going to bring these contributions into the chambers of the house of our God. The temple had many chambers or storerooms around the outside of it. Solomon's temple had them, and then Zerubbabel's temple likewise had them. The grain was brought into these storehouses. You may recall elsewhere in the Old Testament, one of the prophets saying, bring the tithes into the storehouse, Well, that's what's being talked about here. The tithe of the wheat, of the grain, of the grapes, of the olives, the figs. 1/10 of their harvest they bring it, and they store it in the storehouses which were part of the temple. So there's just half a dozen of the specific issues where they promise that they will be loyal to the law of God. Well, you come to chapter 11, the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, but the rest of the people lived outside. Now, chapter 11 is a little bit of an interlude here. The story of the dedication of the people and the dedication of the wall is not yet finished. We're going to finish that in chapter 12, and we're not going to get round to it today because there's an interesting portion there that I haven't got time for now, so I want to talk about that in our final study. So the dedication of the wall is still not complete. We've had the reading of the law, and then the Feast of Tabernacles, and now the swearing of this oath and the drawing up of this document. But before we go on to the final dedication of the wall, there's this small interlude to talk about Nehemiah's policy of thickening up the population of Jerusalem. Now, we saw that in our previous study, didn't we? I think it was back in chapter 7 that it said, yes, chapter 7, verse 4, the city was wide and large, but the people within it were few. Nehemiah saw that the population of Jerusalem was not strong enough, and he wanted to increase the population to make the whole thing more stable, better able to withstand enemy attacks. And we've seen previously some of the problems that the people faced and how Nehemiah took precautions about opening the city gates late in the morning and closing them earlier than otherwise they might close them, just to make sure that they were not open to attack when there were few people up and about to protect the city. Well, now he decides he's going to bring people from all the country areas and settle them in Jerusalem. And his plan is to take 1/10 of the people in all the villages and towns around the country areas and bring them to settle in Jerusalem. And you find that there were many people who volunteered to come, so that it wasn't something that the people had to put up with or that they did against their will. In every town and village, he managed to find 10% of the people who said, okay, we'll come voluntarily. That's the first couple of verses there in chapter 11. The leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, but the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem in this resettlement program. And 9/10 then remain in the other towns. Verse 2, and the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. Isn't it great when you've got people who are so willing to do things? And so often you feel almost apologetic in asking some people to do things for God, because you can almost see the look of disappointment on their face, because it means they're going to miss out on their TV show, or they're not going to be able to go and do something they wanted to do. And there's such a reluctance at times that people have to serve God. You really wonder how serious they are in their Christian lives. Well, here are people that voluntarily came, and the people blessed them. And anybody who's got any responsibility in Christian service, he certainly blesses those who voluntarily and willingly give their time and service for God. It then goes on to outline the people who came and lived in Jerusalem. Verse 3, it talks about people from Judah, and verse 7, it introduces those from Benjamin. And of course, Judah and Benjamin were the two main tribes whose people had resettled in and around Jerusalem. The people who came back from captivity, if you read the book of Ezra, were very largely those of the tribes Judah and Benjamin. In verse 10, he introduces the priests, and in verse 15, he introduces the Levites. And the priests and the Levites were required in Jerusalem, or to live very near Jerusalem, because they were the ones who had to officiate in the services of the temple. There's an interesting note in verse 22. There's an overseer of the Levites. So he was the chief Levite, the archdeacon, I suppose you'd call him today, number one deacon man. He's the chief of the Levites. He came in Jerusalem. His name was Uzzi. In verse 23, an interesting note here about special provision for the singers, just to make sure that those who participated in the temple service were properly catered for. There was a command from the king concerning them and a settled provision for the singers, just to make sure they had enough cash and food to keep them going. It's good to see people so concerned to support those who are engaged in God's service. Instead of adopting a willy-nilly approach and hoping for the best, here are people that actually had a settled provision for them. And an interesting note in verse 24, that there was a Jewish representative at the court of the Persian king. His name is Pethahiah, and it says he was at the king's hand in all matters concerning the people. So they had a spokesman there in Persia to represent their case before the king. And then as you read on through, you find more lists of names. It talks in verse 25 about various villages. It goes on in chapter 12 then to give us names of various priests and Levites and others who returned with Zerubbabel, going back 100 years previously when Zerubbabel came back. The lists of names of the people who came back then formed the basis of, I suppose we'd call it today, the electoral roll, the family registers and all that type of thing of who lived where. And so it repeats some of the details in the opening part of chapter 12, showing the names of the various family groups who lived in and around the city. That brings us up to chapter 12, verse 26. We'll leave the story there because we now come to some very important incidents with some very instructive teaching for us in the final portion of this book, and we'll leave that for our final study.